You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
14 Mission 2, San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
I'm very excited to welcome Dan the Automator Nakamura to the Big Event Podcast Studio. He's shown up in a couple of unexpected places lately, composing the score for Olivia Wilde's Booksmart in theaters now. And he collaborated with Randall Park, who plays Marcus in the Netflix hit Always Be My Maybe, to create the sound for Marcus's fake San Francisco indie hip-hop band Hello Peril. None of this should be a surprise for anyone who's followed the career of the San Francisco native, who developed a national following in 1996 with his first Dr. Octagon collaboration with rap legend Kool Keith. Dan the Automator also put out multiple albums with Deltron 3030, Handsome Boy Modeling School, and the Gorillaz. Along the way, he's developed his own genres with a willingness to experiment and even be silly during a time when the industry was at its most serious. Let's get into Dan the Automator mood with the Deltron 3030 track Mastermind, produced by Nakamura. That's Del the Funky Homo Sapien rapping.
Hey man, let me ask you a question, man. See if you know what's up. Pick this. Who fuses the music with no illusions? Producing the blueprints, clueless automator, defy the laws of nature. Electronic monolith, throw a jam upon the disc. The futuristic loop it with the quickness. Hyperproducing hydrogen fusion liquids. Keep your distance. Keep your
distance.
More on the Always Be My Maybe band Hello Peril. They're a band that hasn't left San Francisco for 16 years, playing the same tiny clubs, rapping about some of the changes in the city, and notably, rapping about Keanu Reeves. It seems like good timing to catch up with Dan the Automator, who made his own choice to stay in San Francisco over the years. He talks about his early years as a musician, started playing the violin at age 3. A foodie who's friends with more chefs than musicians, Nakamura talks about some of the great meals consumed while Always Be My Maybe was shooting in SF. And he talks about his decision not to direct his career for mainstream success, even if success keeps finding him anyway. We're your concierge for culture in the Bay Area. I'm Peter Hartlob, and this is The Big Event. Welcome to The Big Event. Welcome to The Chronicle, Dan the Automator.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing real good. Happy to have you in our archive here.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, I'm from San Francisco, so like seeing all these old photos, we're looking at some Warriors from back in the day when they were good for about 3 years.
Good for about 3 years. I get really excited when someone comes in here and makes requests. So what did you request when you came in?
I requested two things. Well, for mainly, it's all part of one thing. It was like pictures from the Western Edition when there was still the Pink Palace, and it was all like the projects. I asked because my dad had worked for the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, and one of their big projects, one of their more, I guess, successful was to take out the project thing and put in low cost housing. It made it people, you know, like, I guess, pride in ownership and stuff like that.
Yeah,
started to happen, and you know, it's, you can see. I mean, obviously, it's a little more dated now because the Western Edition. It was, I don't know, this was like probably the '70s, so, or maybe early '80s. So
sure, you can see it. Well, I want to talk about Always Be My Maybe, and you scored a movie here now, and a lot of things coming up. But I wanted to go way back to
okay.
And you mentioned your family. When did your family come here, and were you were born here?
I was born in San Francisco. Yes, my grandparents were born in Hawaii. So we've been in the country for a long time. They were born in L.A. and very young. But like when the internment camps, World War II came, they all got relocated essentially to Chicago.
And I'm sorry, Bill Van Niekerk and our librarians here.
All right.
Yeah. I always, when Bill comes in here, I always ask him what he's looking for because it's always really eclectic. Once it was, I think it was debutantes and the coup. He needed like Boots Riley photos from the 90s. But you got a request for Bill if he can find it?
Oh, yeah. I was anything you had from, I was looking for, the Western Edition when it was still had the projects in the Pink Palace and the redo of the Western Edition.
We got anything like that, Bill?
Well, we got some shots and it doesn't look great, but
maybe like the before and after kind of genesis. Yeah. You know?
So you were born in the Sunset District.
No, Richmond, but Richmond. Where I don't even know what hospital I was born in, but yeah, Richmond District for a couple of years and then the Sunset District.
Yeah, were you musical from the beginning? What's your first kind of musical memory?
Well, my first musical memory is a forced memory in the sense of my mom started me on the violin when I was like 3 years old. So I was, you know, doing that. And that wasn't by choice, obviously, at that time. But so I had a lot of classical music in my life for like almost up into high school, actually, a lot. But I'd switched over to like a lot of interest in rap and pop music as they were kind of developing, rap more developing, but pop music being, you know, obviously around. And I just had a lot of love for that kind of music. And on the other side of it, I was playing, classical music a lot.
How, I mean, 3 years old, how dedicated were you?
Oh, you're
terrible. Were you taking a lot of lessons?
Yeah, you take, I don't remember, honestly.
How good were you? Tell me.
Oh, well, I wasn't very good at three, obviously, but like as time went on, I mean, I made it to the level of like, you know, first chair in junior high school. In high school, I didn't play in the orchestra, but I could have probably been, you know, fifth best or, I mean, you know, something like I would have been good, but not like, oh, you're headed towards the symphony good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would have been like, you know, maybe I would have made it into like, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's, yeah. I wasn't pro level. I wasn't like a prodigy or anything like that, though. Not even close.
So what was your first hip-hop experience? Was it local stuff? Because that was starting, or did you kind of start in New York or L.A.
New York.
Terms of your interest?
Yeah, New York stuff was my first interest, is the Run DMCs and all that stuff. I mean, I heard Rapper's Delight. But like, what really sparked my interest the most was this record called Do You Like Scratching by Malcolm McLaren, the world famous Supreme Team. I mean, Malcolm McLaren's more of a Svengali, but like world famous Supreme Team was kind of a mediocre rap-ish group. They kind of portrayed themselves as a radio show on the record. And the song Do You Like Scratching, they had another song called Buffalo Gals, but Do You Like Scratching had this thing like, hey, do you like scratching? And then you hear this turntable like kind of rubbing, but I'm going to say it in a naive kind of way, you know, not like a Run DMC super tight Jam Master J kind of way. And I was like, I understand what they're doing. And after that, I kind of was like, I got to understand and learn how to do this. You know
yeah.
what I mean? And so that was how I not got introduced to hip hop. Maybe Run DMC probably had a lot more to do with like really getting, you know.
Set the scene for me. Like, did you hear it on the radio? Did you go to the Stonestown, you know, Sam Goody?
Well, it was Tower Records, but yeah. but I think, you know, I had, when I was in there, I was buying records since like seventh, sixth grade, just buying records and buying records. And you know, San Francisco is not the origins of rap. You know, there was a lot of interest in soul and funk and whatnot, but rap wasn't like, there wasn't like San Francisco rap artists at the time. So I would listen to like New York rap, and it was a time. It's an interesting thing because like all the records, all these big records, they're the only records, right? So everyone, I mean, globally or, you know, whatever, had, there wasn't like a whole undercurrent of like SF records or, you know, like, or Memphis Records or whatever. Sure. You know what I mean, a couple years later there was, you know, but
yeah, RBL Posse and Rappin' Forte.
I think you know, for me, the first one that I really heard making noise was probably Too Short. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And honestly, that wasn't my kind of rap at the time. I understand a lot of it better now, because then I was really interested in like real like New York hip hop. You know what I mean? Dougie Fresh, The Show, Slick Rick. I mean, rhyming, and then like all the really LL Cool J, and you know, all these guys who are like really flipping lyrics, and Too Short's kind of doing more of a nursery rhyme cadence, and you're hearing it, and like, it's not as, you know, complex, but things aren't about complexity. They're about, you know, statement and what you're saying and impact. You know what I mean? And like, even to this day, I'm learning more about that. You know, the analogous to like when we started making beats, I would try everything in the kitchen sink, you know, try to do all the tricky skill things and all the crazy fills and all this stuff. And like, now I'm like, yeah, it feels good. It's not how hard it was to make, it's how good it sounds. And I think Short falls into that category where it's like a lot of charisma and wit, as opposed to like pure, you know, rhyme delivery skill.
Did you start out wanting to be an MC, or were you interested in production kind of from the beginning?
Basically, for me, I never wanted to be an MC. Now, I played around, rapped a little bit on things and like at home and whatever, but that wasn't really the purpose. That was never the express purpose. What happened to me was I started out as a DJing, you know, mm-hmm. and I was a pretty, I still am. I'm probably world class. I mean, I'm not like top of the, you know what I mean? But like, I can do everything pretty well in terms of like mixing and keeping parties going and whatnot, as opposed to just like one skill set. I'd say I'm in the top 500, whatever, you know, maybe better. I don't know, whatever. I mean, depending on when I practice. If I'm working on records, I'm not practicing turntables and stuff like that much. But anyway, regardless, I thought I was pretty good at the time, you know, at least locally speaking. And what happened was I got to do this show in Stockton, and it was a you know, I don't know, Civic Center Hall kind of show, you
sure.
know. And I think I was probably maybe a senior in high school, something like that, and like I'm doing the show, and then like in the middle they had these two little kids, well, like high school kids, come up, just the local kids, and they were doing this like scratch battle thing, and you know, they were just tearing it up, you know, just two local kids, like, you know, from the valley or whatever, and I'm just like watching them going like, yeah, I'm never going to be that good. I mean, this was literally what went in my mind, like, I'm never going to be that good. And I was already starting to work with beats and stuff. I was like, I'm going to focus harder on the beats. The punchline to that, the long story short, is it turned out those two little local kids, one was named Hubert and the other one was named Mick Spector Mike.
Oh, wow.
So and then I met him those days. We've been friends since that day, basically. But like, literally, like, to me, I mean, they are local kids at the time, you know what I mean? But like, it turns out they're probably two of the best in the world to this day.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So anyway, thank you to them for like making me not really try to pursue dreams as a DJ.
I think of you, everything that you do, it feels like you. It's different. You do eclectic things. I don't see you ever chasing anything commercial, even though things that are commercial seem to come your way.
Yeah.
Was it that way from the beginning? I mean, if you could tell me a little bit about between what you're talking about now and Dr. Octagon, which is when I first...
Yeah, that's when first people really first started to know about me. But like, what it was I had good ideas. But, you know, I'm practicing skills, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm learning how to work equipment and do that kind of stuff. And I kind of started to, from like, you start from like trying to learn what other people are doing to learn what you want to do, you know? And I started getting pretty good at what I wanted to do. But more importantly, my skill set was getting fairly high, you know what I mean? Like on the engineering, whatever type of vibe. And this is all in my parents' basement, and some of the first big records that I was doing were the Soul Sides guys, Shadow and Blacklist. All those records are done in my parents' basement, and then shortly after that, like Dr. Octagon. But like before that all happened, like just before that, I remember people talking to me, like they're like, you know, you're really good at making stuff, but it's different. why don't you, and this is literally before any success at all, any, yeah. And they're like, why don't you, you know, make stuff that sounds more like what's going on right now? I'm like, I'm going to be successful. I'm going to do it on my terms. I'm probably paraphrasing what I was saying.
And what was going on then? Are we talking like Dr. Dre?
Yeah. And I'm just like, you know, I'm cool. I'm going to do what I'm DJ Premier and Dr. Dre are probably like the East and West Coast equivalents of what was good at the time. I'm going to do what I do, and you know, either no one's ever going to hear about me, or I'm going to have my own lane. And I, like I said, I've probably readjusted the words slightly, but it was the sentiment's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I did. I just made my own lane, and my own lane is there till now, really. You know, it's like people try to do what I do, but they're not the good ones because they're not the ones having like the you know, like they're not, they're doing what I wouldn't, or you know what I mean, like they're not striking out on their own, I guess is the way I would put it. But other than that, you know, like I've maintained a certain way of thought and process where, like, you know, my records don't sound the same ever, but they sound like me. I feel like they do, you know.
Yeah. And you said you were at your parents' basement.
Yeah.
Did you feel lured at any point to leave San Francisco as a home base? Were people also, while they're telling you what your style should be, that you should be going to L.A. and New York? Because there aren't a ton of people who are based here.
Yeah, no, I mean, San Francisco's not a music town. I mean, let me take that back. San Francisco's an incredible music town with incredible music history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a music town where people come to strike it rich or get going. I mean, you know, we what we do have, though, that I will stand by for me and for most of the other people, it's like we have this great, diverse 60s history up to the 70s, and we're talking like, you know, all everything from the Haight Street stuff and the Jefferson Starship stuff, but mostly for me, it's like guys like Sly and the Family Stone, you know, rock and black music and this and that. And all this stuff is coming up, and it doesn't sound like anything else in the whole world, you know what I mean? It's its own form of music, you know what I mean? And, I mean, other people, once again, have you know, adapted some of that, of course, over the years, but at the time, it was like that way. And then when we even came out with rap records, it's like, soul-sized, short, Digital Underground, whatever, E40. But what's interesting about all those names is everyone came out independently first. You know what I mean? Everyone just put stuff out because they wanted to. And also, none of that stuff sounded like anyone else's stuff. You know what I mean? We all just did it because, well, we're not in L.A. or New York, so we don't have a label to go walk over to. And we put stuff out. And, you know, a lot of stuff was, you know, poorly received, moderately bad received, but, like, pretty much all these guys, they've had longer careers than most of those, you know, people that whatever, you know, it's because it is pure. So anyway, that's the musical part of San Francisco.
Yeah.
The unmusical part is like, there's no labels here. There's no business here. There's artists don't come here to like get discovered, you know? So yeah, no, there's none of that. I was lucky because I was able to weather the storm of no success to the point where I had enough success where people will come here to work now, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you must have liked it culturally too. What is it about here that makes you want to stay?
Well, it's a complicated thing because as you're growing up, when you're a kid, wherever you grow up, I'm pretty sure you think it sucks. You know, I mean, maybe not if you're in New York. You know, it seems pretty action packed. But like,
I was in Burlingame. I thought it sucked.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You know. So. Yeah. It's exactly.
Bill was too. We worked at the Burlingame Public Library. Yeah.
Well, that must have sucked. Yeah. But no, you grow up and you think everything sucks, right? You know. I mean, like I said, with the exception of probably New York, you know, where like people seem to discover all sorts of things. At least in the mythologies I've read in my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But so anyway, you think it sucks. And like I said, my family was, you know, raised in Chicago. So we would go there every summer. And I'd always be like, yeah, it's cool. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't super jazzed on it. You know what I mean? It was okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this was when I'm a little kid. And then, you know, keep going and going and going. And it's not until, like, I probably actually achieved the level of travel success, meaning, like, when I could go places and play and do things, and I'd been all around the world a lot, that I realized that San Francisco was great. I mean, as great as it was for all these things. I think I liked it enough to not go anywhere, and I used to go to New York a lot even during these times because I hip-hop, you know?
Yeah,
And whatever, records, and the rappers are there, and I would go even when I would, you know, save up money to be there and just go to, like, you know, Downtown Records, Downstairs Records, you know, just, like, live the hip-hop that I would see on TV in the movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff before I was successful, and the Beat Street hip-hop or whatever, you know, and get very very immersed in that culture, you know, and I love New York, but San Francisco, and even as we talk San Francisco today, and I know a lot of people I know, they're like, oh, it's really expensive and gentrification and,
sure,
and tech. Even all that being said, and not to like offend anyone or whatever, but like, you know, there's like 20 great cities in the U.S. You know what I mean? Or arguments for great cities. I'm not talking about great views. I'm just talking about like, you know, your New Yorks, your L.A.'s, your San Francisco's, your Chicago's. I'm going to include like your Portland's and your Seattle. I mean, you know, you go down the line and you find like, you know, as far as metropolitan areas go, there's X amount of cities in the U.S. And, you know, and when you've been to all of them and spent all the time there, I best fit in here, New York, I guess L.A., but New York and here, because in my mind, they're the most international cities, I guess is what
I'll
say.
I know what you're saying.
And like, you know, I can go and, I mean, it's different now, but like, you know, you go and get like different cultural food, you can go whatever, you know, and you can just see the impact of culture. I would say San Francisco would be the most European city besides New York, you know what I mean? Or maybe even, I don't know, but like, and there's something to be said about that kind of vibe that we don't have in a lot of other cities, you know, like spend a few days in Indianapolis, either that's all for you or it's not for you at all, you know what I mean?
Gotcha. No, I hear you. Sorry, Bill Van Niekerken, our librarian. Yes. Did you have any luck, Bill?
I didn't find much. I found...
Bring it on over.
Yeah, they moved some houses, so I got some great shots of the moving houses from there.
Oh, nice.
And then this is a, you know, I found some old houses from 1959 from the area that look pretty beat up. We have a lot more on the Yerba Buena.
Okay, my dad was part of that one too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so you can, if you look up Yerba Buena, or also the other one was when they built the skate park in Hunters Point. That's the other one he did too.
Oh, wow. I'm gonna look for that, and I'll get it to Karen.
Yeah, I'll leave this here for you.
Oh, cool.
Through.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Bill. Yeah. Appreciate your help, man.
Yeah, crazy.
And tell me a little more about the family history. I mean,
we covered most of it. My dad worked for the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency for a long time.
Did your parents both work for the city?
My mom was a teacher, but yeah, she worked in the city college system for a while. So I guess, is that a city job? I'm not sure if that is a city job, but it wasn't within the city, within the confines of, you know, city growth, I guess. Or
how did they feel about your career path, especially in those early years?
Oh, my mom hated it. I mean,
yeah.
She still questioned it. Not questioned it. That shouldn't be the word. She was like, "You should be looking at backup plans pretty far in, you know." And
are we talking like handsome boy modeling school far in, or
we're talking gorillas far in? but my dad's always been like quietly, supportively, not negative about it. My mom was more negative about it. Now she's good with it. But like, you know, we're Asians. You know, Asian Americans. It's like you gotta go to school. You know, it's like I've been around a bunch of Asian Americans just in the last, especially just did this one movie with a lot of Asian Americans and stuff, and everyone has basically the same story, you know?
Yeah.
When are you going to get a job? When are you going to like finish, go to school? Or when are you going to grad school? Or, you know, it's like, it's much more rare to hear someone going like, I'm really encouraging my kid to do the arts, and you know.
You know, my grandparents immigrated from Mexico to San Francisco, and everyone in the family, sons, daughters, grandchildren, all have advanced degrees except me. I dropped out of law school. And even when I got to the Chronicle, I would go to events and my grandmother and grandfather would still be wearing the UC Davis School of Law sweatshirt that I gave them, like subtweet there.
Yeah.
So I get it.
It's an Asian American thing, like really. I mean, it's probably a lot of cultures thing, but Asian American thing, it's really like that.
You had a good segue there to Always Be My Maybe. I just envision you, like, I think you have the best job, because I envision you not going to a bunch of meetings in LA, but just people coming to you and saying, hey, I got this cool project. And Always Be My Maybe seems to cover food. You're into food. Yeah. Beats, there's a definite hip-hop, and then also San Francisco. Tell me how it happened.
Well, it's a little bit of all of that, yes, and you're right about the first part. Like, people come to me sometimes. Even when I have meetings, they're usually pretty pleasant. You know, I mean, I don't ever pitch anything, which, of course, is probably to my own detriment, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, like, and it's not even a story. It's just I don't pitch things that much. But Yeah, with Always Be My Maybe. Randall and I are friends. We're not long years and years friends, but we've been friends for a while. And when Always Be My Maybe came up, him and Ali are executive producers on that movie as well as the writers and everything. He was like, you know, my dream would be to have Dan, you know, do this stuff. And so, while Randall didn't directly call me, he was just like, you know, he just sent it through the channel to me. And then, and of course, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, like, I think for Randall and Ali, you know, especially being their first movie, they're not trying to overstep the bounds of, like, protocol, I guess, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So not trying to go, like, you got this, and then have another producer have to fire me or something, you know what I mean? So, you know, they run it through the thing a little bit. And then it was like, yeah, of course. And, you know, Ali's from San Francisco as well. So it's like, Randall's from LA, but I'm saying, like, Ali's from San Francisco as well. So, like, there's a lot of the feeling about the sound and stuff. Randall being a really avid hip hop head, and then Ali being from here, you know. So it's like the through line is very solid.
Yeah, there's a band in the. It's part of the plot. The band
Hello
is
Peril.
Hello Peril. It's very much like a Dan the Automator type of project. I could see it, except they're playing small
clubs. Well, what it is it's
and
it's
you actually, did three songs
yes,
for
yes,
it.
Yes,
yeah.
I did all the band's music. What it is like that's actually a reimagining of a band that Randall had, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, kind of hip-hop jazz band, you know, doing his thing with all these people, you know, with all these people that he grew up with and listening to the same kind of music. And the difference is this band never stopped. Like, you know, he just it kept going, you know what I mean? Like his college band, it's kind of like an imagination if his college band just kept playing for years and years after.
Yeah.
That's
I
really
think
worth.
16 years.
Yeah. Okay, 16. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I saw so many things here that just felt like a lot of people who were from San Francisco and the Bay Area were part of it. Souls of Mischief is on the soundtrack. I saw a Handsome Boy Modeling School poster up on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have your fingers in other things here?
Not specifically. I mean, I was around and we were talking about stuff and we had mentioned, you know, things. But Randall and Ali, like I said, they're very Bay Area friendly. Randall, like I said, he's from LA, but like when Ali was up here doing stand-up and all that stuff, he would come up and I mean, they've been friends forever, and he would come up and do stand-up up here and stuff, so he's had a lot of time in the Bay Area, and he's also of the and she as well are both of the mind of that kind of hip-hop.
Yeah.
It's part of the formulative thing, so it's really more them, and then we fill in some of the blanks, you know, here and there, but like it's really their experience, that which is our kind of our collective Bay Area experience. Yeah.
Well, it's a fun movie. It's a very, very Bay Area movie, and Hello Peril just felt so authentic to me. It feels like, you know, my friend's band that's playing at Hotel Utah or something.
Yes.
But the lyrics, I'm going to read a little bit of it for our listeners. Sure. Welcome to the city which used to be free of suckers.
Welcome to the city that used to be free of suckers till the techies came in Hummers and colonized the gutters. If I see another hipster open in a coffee shop, I'll make a body drop with my signature karate chop.
Yes.
Is that you and Randall working on that? I mean, how did
No,
the...
Randall wrote all that stuff.
Yeah.
Randall wrote it. In fact, if you're in that one, there's a very, very clear reference to Discolandia in that song. It's right before that, right after that. But like, it's something about a record store being co-opted to something. But anyway, it's Randall. I mean, you know, Randall's obviously he's an actor, but he's a comedian to a degree. I mean, he's a comic actor a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But he's also very clever. And so when we did this stuff, he wrote the lyrics. I did a couple little things with, like, you know, chorus suggestions, not lyrically so much, but the way it should stack. And some of it went in there, some of it, you know, didn't. But what it was his lyrics expressing, like, his view of San Francisco from being a San Franciscan, even though he's actually, like I said, more of a visiting San Franciscan, I guess, honorary, you know, whatever. But if you look at the... everything that was just said there, it's like it's kind of on the nose sentiment wise, you know.
I love the three songs. There's Hello, and then Tennis Ball, and which I'll just let people see the movie. I'm not even going to try to explain that. And then, you know, spoiler, I will have warned people ahead of time, Keanu Reeves, the song called Keanu Reeves, which ends up being almost like a, it reminds me of The Hangover when they're showing the photos. It's like this credit bonus hilarious thing. How did you feel when you saw the movie and saw how these songs were weaved in?
You know, it's funny because it was, I was really happy, but I gotta tell you, not why I was happy, but I had been on set for like a lot of the band stuff because I was consulting in terms of like, you know, how the band should be playing and look and making sure the instrumentation and setup was physically possible and doable. And besides, if anyone's asking how Randall could be playing the keyboards and then go up in front and rhyme, it's called a looping pedal.
Yeah.
We had looping pedals on the floor, so you play the loop, hit it, and go. I mean, we weren't playing live. I'm just saying that it's totally doable. We wanted to make sure everything there was possible.
Sure.
So anyway, back the way I saw the movie was there was an actual theater premiere in Westwood in L.A. and of course, all projects everyone does, you know, you're either disgusted with them or you're proud of them, I guess, right?
Yeah.
But this was beyond that because we had this party, yellow carpet actually. It was a yellow carpet. but where all these people come, but it was like all sorts of people, and it was funny because like they're all kind of our friends. Not every single person, but like, you know, I'm going to mention like a guy like Bobby Hundreds, you know, who actually has a book out right now about streetwear, but you know, the Hundreds and all these people came out who were part of like our, I don't want to say clique because we're not all that tight or whatever, but like Asian American guys and girls who were doing things, you know what I mean? And to see everyone in one place was cool. But then to see this movie and realize that, and this movie is by no, it's a rom-com. It's by no means subversive or anything, but like there's little details in there that like, when you start to catch them, you realize like it's a real nod to the Asian American pop culture. I mean, like wearing a Stay Angry shirt or whatever. You know, I mean, it's like you see these things and you're like, someone did it. Like they put together not my experience or anyone else, but like someone was paying attention to all the little steps along the way that could get to having a movie like this made. But every one of these were like small, not for me on every single one, but were all small touch points, cultural touch points that we being Asian Americans have gone through since like the 90s basically, you know what I mean? And so like when you see it all happen, you're just like, I can't believe this was made. I can't believe I was a part of this. And when I'm saying a part of it, I'm like, even if your thing was like on the wall or something that existed and it's gotten to the point where this can actually exist, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's gotten to the point where like people can do that kind of thing, you know? And that's so, it was kind of like not just being proud of it, there's a certain kind of feeling like it was different than like other premieres and things I had done in movies and things that had come out, you know, because of those kind
of
things.
Because of that. Yeah. And the shooting, I got to ask you, you're a big food guy and there's a real huge food through line through all this. Did you get any good meals out of this?
Well, yeah, lots of good meals. Ali is a big Vietnamese food fan. And she was always trying to she was always trying to get me to go to Turtle Tower with her, which, of course, I love Turtle Tower. It was good. But we did R&G Lounge together. Randall really is a fan of the old school booth kind of thing. And we did his favorite in San Francisco is Tadich Grill. So these are like more classic standbys.
Oh, yeah.
But, like,
that's old
school. Yeah, but we had a great time. We could do that. And beyond that, like... In LA and whatnot, and here even like we eat well.
Yeah.
but yeah, as far as like right down to it, Tadich Grill, Vietnamese pho places.
What do you think about food in San Francisco? I know you actually, I think you had a meal with our new restaurant critic, Solejo, is that one of the reasons that's kept you here?
I don't think that's the reason I've been here, but San Francisco is one of the best food towns in the country. I mean, basically, SFLA New York, you know what I mean? And if I was going to put in order ethnic, I'd probably go LA, but restaurants overall, I'd go New York and San Francisco, very small third. But that, with the caveat, is those are much bigger cities, and quality per inch in San Francisco might be higher, you know?
Yeah.
So, So, but yeah, they're all great. But I mean, I love eating all over the world. It's not like fancy food or whatever. It's any food.
Sure. Well, I wanted to ask you about Booksmart too, and okay. just working with movies. Was that something you always wanted to do? And I think of you as such an independent person. Is it harder to be independent when you're working with a movie, even if it's an indie?
Well, with movies, I mean, first, yes, I always wanted to do movies to a degree. I always want to do anything artistic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if someone, I mean, literally, I've done music to bolster up art shows and stuff. I mean, anything that's artistic that I like. So movies are obviously a decent way to, like, you know, combine, or maybe the only real current way to combine, you know, picture and story and thing, you know. So yeah, I'm all into that. With Booksmart, Olivia came to me and was like, you know, would you be interested in you know, doing the music from a movie? And like, I was like, you know, let's talk about it. And you know, it's a teen high school movie, and I was, you know, it was very smart and very interesting. So I was very excited to get a chance to do it. And then I had to kind of immerse myself into every John Hughes, every Fast Time at Ridgemont High, every Clueless and Can't Hardly Wait or whatever. Reason being, not that we're trying to make music like any of that, but like, I wanted to see what stuck, what would stay, you know what I mean? Because obviously with a high school movie, there's going to be a lot of contemporary music in there. So I wanted to figure out how to make it all like flow together and go. And for me, like, you know, kids, you know, there's like rap, trap music, for example, right? I didn't want to do anything like that because that music is dated. And you're like, oh, it's 2018 music or 2019 or whatever. I wanted to do stuff that like got the feeling, the energy, and the exuberance of the kids, and then like at the same time, you're not gonna like listen to it and go like, that's so whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was really exciting, and you know, I mean, this one was I think a lot about the feelings that you get from that kind of movie.
Yeah.
And how you can come about and do that.
Cool. Well, I hope you do more. I love that movie, and I didn't know it was your work until I always watch the credits.
Right.
I get mad at Netflix because sometimes they put the credits up in the corner,
yeah,
and
yeah,
I got to go fish them out again.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was excited to see you were a part of it.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah. I got a few kind of lightning round questions here. First of all, first concert in the Bay Area. Do you remember?
No, but but I did, first concert that probably, like, I was like, well, that's a concert, was I went to the Purple Rain concert tour at the Cow Palace.
And that was, in 85?
Yeah. That was one of the ones that I was like, wow. You know what I mean? Like, probably not the very first concert I've ever been to, but maybe the first, like, dynamic one, you know?
How'd you get the tickets? Because that was a lot of waiting in line.
I don't remember. I think maybe one of my friends waited, like, from overnight or late or whatever, but I don't think I was waiting overnight, but you know,
yeah,
but like, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, what would you think?
I
of
mean,
the concert,
you know, I thought it was really, really, really impressive. I have like a really fond spot for Prince at that time. I didn't realize it, but like, that was probably the last time I had fond thoughts for Prince in terms of musically speaking. Like, Around the World in the Day is where my Prince listening kind of dips a little bit, but like, up to that point, like, just the way he did what he did was incredible. And also, I wasn't really as well versed yet on understanding, like, I don't know, what Little Richard, James Brown, you know, Jimi Hendrix, and all those influences as well. And to see someone just put it all together without me understanding what he's doing was just kind of mind blowing. And also, you know, the Purple Rain, there's movie, there's
oh yeah, I know,
everything.
No,
everything.
My sister got to go, and I was too young,
right.
So you know,
yeah.
You work with so many great SF people. I remember Lovage when it came out.
Yeah.
I remember going to Amoeba. Like,
yeah.
I was super poor.
Yeah.
And I was going to Amoeba, like, every time trying to see if I can get it used. And then at some point I checked and it was like, you know, $100-something online. And then finally streaming came along, which I think actually makes things kind of boring.
Yeah,
you don't have
is.
To hunt anymore.
Yeah.
But all this to say, you know, that was with Mike Patton,
yes.
And you've worked with him a lot.
Yeah.
Is there a San Francisco person who you've wanted to work with, but you can't? I would almost say living or dead, but...
Well, I guess
You've worked with so many.
Yeah, I guess the one that I mean, I'm not trying to work with them because yeah. there would be too much of a for numerous reasons. And I don't know if he's technically San Francisco, but I'd say Sly and the Family Stone. It's not it means a lot to me in terms of black rock. You know what I mean? In soul, that's just so good. And you know he's around, but you know he's obviously got his issues, and it's not something I'd be really trying to do. You know what I mean? But yeah. like, but it's like you know we get to this point like San Francisco, like it's like. With me and Mike, especially, it's like, well, we've been talking a lot recently because of Warriors, you know, and like he's actually a Lakers fan. No, he's actually a Warriors fan first.
No, I'm such a fan of the band. It's gonna affect my ability to enjoy
yeah, you,
it.
Well, if you see him, you can complain to him a lot like yeah. Lakers, but he actually loves the Warriors. But so we get into that a lot, and you know there's you know a lot of things going on right now. Obviously, so we've been going analyzing every signing and whatever. But but yeah, no, after you go through. You go through a period of time of the Bay Area, you realize, A, like, Mike makes a whole lot of records I don't listen to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the ones that I do, I love them. And the influence points he gets into, I love. And it kind of tend to see that a lot with Bay Area artists. They seem to have a lot of interest in a lot of different kinds of music. I'd say Sly would probably be one that I would not wish I worked with at all, but like that would have been if something great had happened, that would have been
great. That would have been a story. Yeah. Physical music, do you still go to record stores? Do you get to Amoeba?
I don't go to Amoeba as much as I would want to, but
yeah.
But what I do like records. I won't say like I'm sitting around like pulling them out and doing. I have a nice setup to do that. And when I do that, it's really, it's not a more important feeling, but you feel like you've gone to the production of it. I kind of don't. I mean, I've got like not like a lot of records, but you know, under 10,000, but more than 5,000. You know what I mean? You know, like a decent size of albums. And I don't find myself digging through them all the time to play them all the time, but I love records.
Nice. This one's going to disappoint me, I'm sure, but Chronicle Paperboy, did you ever deliver?
No, I did not. I did not deliver papers.
Did you do nothing?
Never. No.
In the sunset? You got the...
No, not too many hills?
It's not a...
there's a few.
There's a few.
I did not deliver papers, but I did have friends that did, and I understand the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I'm not a really early morning person.
All right. Well, and last one, what have you got coming up next? What's the next album I'm going to buy?
Next album, well, I'm doing some work slowly with Prince Paul. We're going to do another Handsome Boy Modeling School record.
Nice.
We're actually a little behind schedule. We were supposed to be really starting in January, but he was doing some Netflix movie stuff, so we were a little bit got delayed a little bit. We have to get back on track. Been doing working on this project with Jess Blaze for about a year now that we should try to finish, and we're doing a new Deltron thing coming up. Maybe that might be the soonest one. We're starting to work on it. When we start to work on it, it'll go faster. You know.
Awesome. Well, I got a lot of good music to look forward to. Thank you for coming to the Chronicle.
Thank you for having me.
For the archive and congratulations on the movie. And
One other thing. Because May those two movies came out, but the other thing I had come out in May is I had a TV show called Broken Bread come out. KCET. It was me and Roy Choi doing the music, Roy Choi doing the show. It's Roy's show.
Oh, awesome.
But it's just really about the future of food and sustainability, and it's really interesting to ask some interesting questions. It's not like a entertainment, like for entertainment's sake piece, but like and Roy has a show right now with called The Chef Show with Jon Favreau, so that not to be mistaken with that one, which is more, you know, social, whatever. Mm-hmm. This one's more social. I mean, if you get a chance, I think it's a good thing to check out.
I'm definitely going to check it out. Thank you for coming to the Chronicle, sir. Appreciate it. You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guest, Dan the Automator. Our producer today is me, Peter Hartlob. Supervising producers are King Kaufman and Libby Coleman. Executive producer is Tim O'Rourke, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community. Read our columns and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.